Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Hala Gouris, and with me in the studio here at KBOO Community Radio is Will Seaman. Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
Yes, good morning. This morning we turn to a topic somewhat removed from the day-to-day realities of the occupation in Palestine, but a topic nonetheless that bears on these issues in a central way, and that's the topic of Zionism.
With the recent controversy over the UN conference on racism in Geneva this last week, we were reminded of the conflict over the previous UN conference on racism in Durban, South Africa, back in 2001, where issues of the Israeli occupation and discrimination in the State of Israel were discussed, and where previously conference participants were accused of racism and anti-Semitism based on these criticisms aimed at Israel.
Now, although we've discussed lots of controversial issues on this program in the past, I think it's fair to say that today's topic has the potential to stir up a lot of emotions. So let me apologize in advance to our listeners if you hear things on today's program that you feel are hurtful or inaccurate. And I hope it's clear that I'm speaking to folks on all sides of this issue. We're going to take calls today, and we want the discussion to be open and frank and direct. But we also want folks to be respectful and considerate and open to hearing some strong opinions today.
And let me reiterate what Will just said. We encourage your calls, your participation, but we really also encourage you to be as respectful as possible, even though you will hear, will likely hear divergent views on Zionism. This is actually our second program we've done on this topic. We spoke with Joel Covell, author of Overcoming Zionism, back in October, and hopefully we'll have other folks on in the future to continue this discussion. So please call in with your questions and comments. And please help us make this conversation productive and compassionate for everybody involved.
And that number to call to take part in today's program, 503-231-8187. Please be patient if we don't get to you right away. Again, the number 503-231-8187 if you want to take part in today's discussion of Zionism. And with us today to talk about Zionism is New York University Professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History, Zachary Lockman. Professor Lockman is a researcher and teacher in the areas of socioeconomic, cultural, and political history of the modern Middle East under the influence of the New History, New Social History, and History from Below movements of the 1960s and 70s. Professor Lockman did his doctoral dissertation on the emergence and evolution of a working class and labor movement in Egypt from the late 19th century until the Second World War.
Professor Lockman has also done a great deal of research on Palestine, producing a 1989 edited volume on the Intifada and a 1996 book on relations between Arab and Jewish workers and labor movements in Palestine during the British Mandate period. He has served as president of the Middle East Studies Association and as a contributing editor of Middle East Reports. Professor Zachary Lockman, thank you for joining us on One Land, Many Voices.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, let's go ahead and begin with the basics, Professor. What is Zionism?
Well, as you suggested, it's a very touchy subject and a complex one. The first thing maybe to be said is that Zionism, at least in its origins, is a form of nationalism. Right? It's a Jewish nationalism. If we go back to the 19th century, when the great majority of Europe's Jews and of the world's Jews, in fact, lived in Europe, and especially in the Tsarist Empire under the regime of the Tsars in Russia, all the peoples of Europe, or many of the peoples of Europe, were increasingly coming to see themselves not first and foremost as Catholics or Protestants or as the subjects of the emperor of one kind or another, Austria-Hungary, but as members of nations. And this idea that people first and foremost belong to nations, that humanity is divided up into nations, each of which has its unique language, its unique history, its unique culture and spirit, became very widespread in the 19th century, changed the map of Europe ultimately, and changed the map of the world. Not very surprisingly, with Italians, Poles, Ukrainians, Germans, on and on, all the other peoples of Europe, turning towards a national definition, some Jews, as an oppressed and persecuted minority, began in the 19th century to do the same. A minority of Jews, by all means, but some Jews began saying that the problem of the Jews, the fact that Jews were persecuted, excluded, did not in many parts of Europe have full citizenship, could only be fixed, could only be resolved, if they too had a nation state of their own. So the early Zionist thinkers said that rather than social revolution, rather than education, rather than social reform, rather than immigration to some place where they might have more freedom, only if the Jews had a nation state of their own could they be full and equal citizens, take their rightful place among the nations of the world as a people with sovereignty. So that's going back to the origins.
At the risk of oversimplifying things, had there not been anti-Semitism, pogroms, etc., would Zionism have existed?
It's a good question. It's hard to say. Certainly, Zionism was one of many responses to the changes that took place, mainly in Europe, again, where the great bulk of the world's Jews were living in the course of the 19th century. So in some parts of Europe, in Western Europe, in Britain, France, Germany, Austria, Hungary, Jews gradually were emancipated. They achieved the legal rights of citizens. And those states, at least in theory, treated them as full and equal citizens. There remained anti-Semitism, there remained instances of discrimination in various forms, but at least they were citizens. That was not the case in the Russian Empire, in the Tsarist Empire, where Jews were not considered equal citizens, where the government was openly anti-Semitic, where Jews were discriminated against, forced to live in certain regions, barred from others, barred from certain professions, and then from the 1880s subjected to mob attacks, to pogroms. And this led, of course, a lot of them, huge numbers, to pick up and leave and come to the United States and other parts of the world. Many others turned towards socialism. They joined revolutionary movements in the hope of creating a new democratic Russia and socialist Russia in which Jews would be equal. And a few began in the 1880s to turn towards Zionism, clearly under the impact of anti-Semitism, although there were also social and economic changes that influenced this.
Professor, now might be a good time for us to take our first caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, hello.
Good morning.
This is John, calling from Southeast Portland. I'm enjoying the discussion so far. And, I was born in 1944. The State of Israel came into existence, I believe, in 1948. And for my whole life, I've been watching one war after another, fought by Israel, sometimes as a surrogate for Western interests, but sometimes not, and various Arab states and now Arab quasi-states fighting. And it seems to me, first of all, a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that there was a lot of backing for the early state of Israel from Russia. In fact, some of the arms and so forth that they got when they were not able to get them from the West came via the Eastern Bloc. And so, Israel, in its inception, had a lot of socialist leanings, which have now, everything has gotten turned on its head. But the thing I wanted to ask you folks about is, it seems to me that for much of this period, Israel and the Arab states were stand-ins for the great power struggles between the United States and the Soviet Union. And as these stand-ins, they were always allowed to, they had these little fights where, which were very important to Israel. Its survival was at stake. But on the other hand, there was never a resolution because whenever the Israelis were victorious, that would all be called back. So there, and my understanding is that there's still a state of war that exists, for example, between Israel and Saudi Arabia, that there's never been a peace treaty, and it seems to me that the Saudis and the Gulf oil states are really actually the key to the whole, to unraveling the whole problem, because they have the wealth that could help the Palestinians. I mean, if you think about it,
caller, I wonder if we could stick to the topic of Zionism at least as much as possible, or bring it back. If you could bring it back to the issue of Zionism.
Well, this all has to do with Zionism because Zionism is a failure at this point. It's a complete canard for these. That's the ideology of a Jewish state. It's not going to work. We all know it's not going to work now. Because the demographics speak against it, but in order to unlock the problem, it's going to have to be addressed in a lot of different ways. The way it's being addressed now as simply an Israeli occupation of Palestine doesn't lead anywhere, except to more of the same problems. You could go the direction of having a secular state, which means undoing...
Caller, can we give our guest the chance to respond?
Sure. I'd just like some comments on those points.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Well, Professor, let's deal with this issue brought up by our caller about Zionism being a failure at this point.
Okay. So I think the caller touched on something that's the heart of the matter. Zionism begins as a Jewish nationalism. We can do a thought experiment. Let's think about it this way. If the early Zionist movement, which enjoyed only minority support among Jews, most Jews, religious and secular Jews, originally rejected Zionism and for many decades on into the 20th century. But let's say the Zionist movement said, okay, we're going to find some empty island in the middle of the Pacific and we're going to set up a Jewish state there. So some Jews might have ended up there. They might have set up a Jewish state, but that would have been that in some sense. But in fact, the Zionists, of course, didn't want to go just anywhere. They wanted to set up a Jewish state, achieve a Jewish majority through immigration, settlement, and so on, and eventually political sovereignty in what they saw as their ancestral homeland, Palestine. But of course, Palestine was already densely populated by another people, by Arabs who were at the same moment coming to see themselves as not just Arabs generally, but as Palestinian Arabs. Which meant that Zionism had to be not just a movement of immigration to some other place, but a movement of colonization. And that meant that it had to, against the resistance of the indigenous population, carve out a state for itself, acquiring land, establishing settlements, and struggling for a majority and for political power. So here we get to Zionism being not just a national movement in the same sense that the Italian national movement or the Polish or whatever, those were all places where there were a lot of Poles, right, where Poles or Italians or other peoples were the majority in some distinct territory. Palestine had very, very few Jews when Zionism emerged. So you then get Zionism as a colonizing movement and a movement of settlement as well. And outside powers from the beginning were very involved because Zionism could never have come anywhere close to achieving its goal of a large Jewish population in Palestine, given the fact that the indigenous population resisted this. They didn't feel that their land should be transformed into a Jewish state without the support of an outside power. First Britain, which conquered Palestine and endorsed Zionism in the Balfour Declaration in 1917, and its British colonial rule, which crushed Arab resistance and made it possible for the Zionist movement to achieve a state in 1948. And then after 1948, the State of Israel needed and sought and secured outside big powers to help itself. First France in the 1950s, and then, as we know from the later 1960s, the United States, which developed a very close relationship with Israel and has given Israel $150 billion plus dollars in military and economic aid and political support and on, without which Israel certainly would not have been able to do the kinds of things that it's done since 1967, the occupation, the settlements, and all the rest.
Professor, if I may, we have several callers on the line. What we would like to do is ask those callers to be patient, please. This morning we're speaking with New York University Professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History, Zachary Lockman. Professor, you talk about colonization, but can you tell us about whether the idea of transfer of the local indigenous population of Palestine accompanied the Zionist movement?
It was certainly there in some sense from the beginning. If you look at Herzl's diaries, he understands that Palestine in 1900, let's say, is an overwhelmingly Arab country. 95% of the population is Arabic-speaking. They're largely peasants. They and their ancestors have been in this land for many, many centuries. And it's unlikely, and Zionist leaders come to understand this, it's unlikely that they're going to give up without a fight. So what do you do then? You want to create a Jewish state. You need to do something with this non-Jewish population. Now, there were many Zionists who felt that something could be worked out, that there could be some compromise, that the two peoples could live together in one land. But there's a certain logic here. If you want to create a Jewish majority, in the face of indigenous resistance, if you want to create a Jewish state, you've got to do something with this population. Even in 1948, when Israel was established, two-thirds of the population of Palestine was Arab. Jews were just one-third. So obviously you can't have a viable Jewish state if the majority of the population is Arab. And even within the territory which the United Nations assigned to the Jewish state, almost half the population was Arab. So it's not very surprising that in the course of the fighting in 1948, much of the Arab population was displaced. Some of them were simply expelled by military force. Others fled, as people do when fighting erupts, and then Israel refused to let them return to their homes, demolish their villages, establish Jewish towns, settlements in their place. So in some sense, the logic of the situation, the whole logic of Zionism, means that you have to do something about the facts of demography, and you have to achieve that by coercion and violence, because people won't leave of their own accord, for sure.
Now, Professor Lockman, you've just mentioned that there were strands within Zionism that were looking for some other kind of accommodation with this fact, this demographic fact of Palestine at the beginnings of the Zionist project. Can you talk about the different types of Zionism, for example, labor Zionism and revisionist Zionism and liberal Zionism and religious Zionism, and maybe talk a little bit about how there appears to have been something of an internal struggle for what the character of the Zionist enterprise would be?
Sure. Well, Zionism was, from its inception at the very end of the 19th century, a pretty diverse movement. People like Herzl, who was the founder of Zionism as a modern international movement, was a very sort of mainstream Central European bourgeois liberal, with the good and bad sides of that. Right? He envisioned a future Jewish state. Somehow everything would work out, at least this is what he said in public. The Arabs would be happy, they'd benefit, land prices would rise, prosperity would come, they'd be happy about this. And he couldn't see that unsurprisingly, the local population, the Arabs, would resist Zionism, as any people would. You also had a strong socialist stream within Zionism, which was very powerful from the 1920s down into the 1970s. Now it's been quite marginalized and is much, much, much weaker as a political force. People like Ben-Gurion, who was Israel's first prime minister and a dominant figure in the Zionist movement and later in the State of Israel for many decades. And they envisioned creating a sort of Jewish socialist or social democratic society. But they also pushed for something else, which had interesting results, right? People often compare Israel and South Africa, and of course there are similarities one can point to, but there also is an important difference. In South Africa, the white minority wanted to dominate the entire country, and they created a system in which much of the working class, the people who did the actual labor in the factories and the mines, were African, whereas the whites tended to be much better off. They wanted to dominate the top ends of the social structure. Especially the socialist Zionists wanted to create a whole separate Jewish society. They were used to joke that they would know that there was a proper Israel, a proper Jewish society in Palestine, when there were Jewish prostitutes and Jewish thieves and Jewish beggars, a society from top to bottom, which meant excluding the Arabs, not exploiting them, but simply excluding them as far as possible. So in a way, they laid the basis for the future Jewish state by setting up a separate enclave that in every respect was fully Jewish and excluded the indigenous population, again, rather than exploiting them, as the case was in South Africa. You had religious Zionists and so on. And from the 1920s, you had what was called revisionist Zionists, a right-wing Zionist trend, which in a way set the tone that, at least in what people actually did rather than what they said, for much of the future. In the 1920s, a Zionist leader named Vladimir Jabotinsky began saying that, look, the Arabs are going to resist us like any people would. Right? In any kind of similar situation, the local population would resist. Why would they accept being made a minority in their own country? So what we have to do is have enough force to compel them to accept a Jewish majority and ultimately a Jewish state. And this became, in practice, the policy of the Zionist movement. even of the socialist Zionists who denounced Jabotinsky as an extremist, but in practice, and we can see this in 1948, adopted his policies. And Israel today, one I think can say, continues to have that idea that the only thing the Arabs understand is force, that the only way to deal with the Palestinians is to keep them down, and that only by its superior military force will Israel be able to hold on to what it has, will continue to dominate as it does today all of Palestine and continue the Zionist project.
Could you also talk about the counter trends within Zionism to the views of Jabotinsky? So I'm thinking, for example, of the writings of Martin Buber on this topic.
Sure. Well, there were always small circles, generally intellectuals, people associated with universities and so on, who argued for a different kind of Zionism, who didn't put the focus on power, on political power, but felt that Zionism should first and foremost deal with the problems of the Jewish people, create some kind of center, cultural center for the revival of the Jewish people in Palestine. And that meant that there was room for some kind of compromise. And a few of them before 1948 even argued for a binational state, a joint Jewish-Arab state in Palestine. But I think the truth is that they were always fairly marginal, and that the tougher political leaders always were in the ascendant and could marginalize and dismiss these ideas because people like Ben-Gurion on the left and Jabotinsky on the right could say, these guys are dreamers. The Arabs are not going to accept a Jewish state if they can stop it. And the only thing that's going to achieve a Jewish state ultimately is our superior force. And I think they were proven correct, that it took force and violence to achieve a Jewish state in Palestine in 1948. And Israel has remained because it continues to overcome the resistance, the opposition of the Palestinians, who have held on to their aspirations for a state of their own in some part of what was once Palestine. Now the leadership has been willing to accept the West Bank and Gaza, but even that is something that Israel is not at this point willing to concede. So I think there's a logic to this struggle, which, given the commitment of Israel to the Zionist vision, continues to generate conflict and a reliance on military force.
I'd like to explore another dimension to this, which is the question of religious versus secular Zionists and how much of the leadership initially were largely secular Jewish leaders. But let's go to the next caller. Let's get our community involved here. And caller, what's your question for our guest today?
You know, that's a perfect transition. Thanks for taking my call. You pointed out, Professor, the possible similarities between South Africa and the Holy Land in the way things have gone. But I'm wondering, for instance, North America has its own history of this bloody conquest by outsiders, if you will. And I'm wondering to what extent much of that manifest destiny here on this continent was led by religious zealots of a sort. And I'm wondering what the American fundamentalist movement today, how much influence and how tightly woven together are they with the modern Zionists? And I'm wondering how that can tie in, and if you can talk about modern American fundamentalism as it feeds some basically racist ideas. Thanks.
Sure. Well, that's a good question. Certainly, I think all settler colonial societies have some similarities, and certainly the United States in its origin is a settler colonial society. People of European origin came and through force dispossessed, displaced, in some cases exterminated the indigenous population or reduced them to very small enclaves and ultimately possessed this very vast area. So there are parallels here, and there are other cases. Australia, one can multiply the examples. So the difference is, I think, that Zionism is a much newer phenomenon. Right? The United States began this process, or European settlers in North America began this process back in the 1500s, right? So, and largely eliminated most indigenous resistance pretty effectively. Right? The Zionism began at the very end of the 19th century and really got going when the trend began shifting the other way around the world, right? The whole process of decolonization began to unfold in the middle of the 20th century, just as Zionism achieved its triumph with the creation of the State of Israel. So to much of the world, Israel looks sort of like an anomaly, because here you have this Jewish state in a land that was once fairly recently, right, a couple of generations ago, majority Arab, and the indigenous population, the Palestinians, still have not realized any kind of their national aspirations in any part of the land, and Israel looks more and more like a colonial power in an era when this is no longer acceptable to the vast majority of the people in the world. The other piece of it is the American religious connection, and you're certainly right. We all know that in the last 10, 15 years, there have been a lot of American right-wing fundamentalist Protestants who identify very, very closely with Israel. This has some older theological roots, very complicated in certain versions of Protestant theology, and it also has political roots. There was sort of a convergence as Israel came to be seen in the 70s and 80s and 90s as a Cold War ally, first against the international communist threat as it was perceived, the Soviet Union, and then against the threat of Islam in the 1990s. These forces in American society latched on to their alliance with Israel, which had a theological piece to it as well as a political piece. It's from a Jewish perspective, it's extremely strange, of course, because these same Christian fundamentalists in the United States believe that with the Second Coming, Jews are all going to go to hell, and only those who are saved, so to speak, will survive. So it doesn't have a very happy ending for the Jews. On the one hand. On the other hand, they have this whole complicated place for Israel and for the Jews in their imagined scenario for the end days. And this provides extra support from a theological perspective for their unquestioning support for Israel, and in fact for the most right-wing retrograde forces in Israeli society and politics.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices, and you're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. Also streaming audio on KBOO's website at www.kboo.fm. And if you've missed any of our previous programs, or if you just want to listen again to one of our past guests, all of our programs are available on demand at www.pdxjustice.org, where you'll also find links to other great videos and audio programming. With us by phone is New York University Professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History, Professor Zachary Lockman. Let's go ahead and take one more caller. Go ahead, caller. What's your question?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Two things I wanted to explore a little bit is, one, you've been talking about colonialism or neocolonialism, and, you know, the British had Palestine as a colony, and they also had Egypt. They knew that they were losing that influence over there, so I kind of look at this also as an experiment by the West to enable Israel to come into existence as kind of a new experiment for colonialism. And if things didn't go wrong, then of course you could always blame it on the Jews, which has been a popular thing to do throughout history. The second point is there seems to be a tremendous amount of enablers, and I know it's popular now to attack Zionism as a philosophy and whatnot, but there seems to be a vast people that are enabling that sort of action that would never claim themselves to be Zionists, but again, they're allowing it to happen, you know, or using that as a cover. So those two points, if you could, please.
Well, sure. It's certainly true, I think, that Zionism, as I suggested earlier, would never have gotten off the ground and gotten anywhere near the possibility of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine without the support of British colonial rule. Now, the British were interested in this for a variety of reasons. Some were their own imperialist reasons. They liked the idea of what some people called a Jewish Ulster, right, implanting a Jewish minority in Palestine who would be loyal to Britain. Others had different notions. There were some Christian Zionists who liked this idea, again, for their own reasons. There were many factors that went into it, but certainly British support was crucial. Although the British Zionist Alliance broke down by the end of the 30s, and ultimately, as I'm sure many listeners know, in the years just leading up to the establishment of Israel, There was an insurgency by the Jews in Palestine against British rule, because by that point the Zionist leadership felt strong enough to challenge the British and go for a state, even if the British were no longer enthusiastic about this. Can you remind me of the second part of the question there, or the second piece?
Carl, are you still there? No, I'm afraid not.
Sorry.
And I'm afraid I've forgotten as well. I want to make a couple of announcements about what's coming up here on KBOO this morning. Today is the birthday of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and KBOO is presenting a special on Mumia and the many other political prisoners held in U.S. prisons. At 10 o'clock, you'll hear an interview with Ashanti Alston, a former political prisoner and co-chair of the Jericho Movement. At 10:30, Kent Ford, father of Patrice Lumumba Ford of the Portland Seven. And at 11, a look at the Green Scare, modern COINTELPRO. Throughout today, special programming on political prisoners here in the United States and some very important events coming up here in Portland, in the Portland area, an American lawyer in Gaza. This is a talk by Thomas Nelson, a local lawyer with the National Lawyers Guild, who took part in a delegation to Gaza. That's happening Sunday, May 3rd at 5:30 p.m. at the Corvallis Benton County Public Library. That's in Corvallis, of course. And devastated Gaza Eyewitness Report. And this is a representative of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom reporting on her visit to devastated Gaza in March of this year as well, just last month. And that is Tuesday, May 5th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church here in Portland. And I also want to mention, even though this is shameless self-promotion, I'm taking part in a panel discussion, I think a worthwhile panel discussion. I'm not the only one involved. That's Israel and the Misuse of Anti-Semitism, Jewish Activists Speak Out. We have Sophie Block of Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. I'll be taking part, Ned Fuchsen of Jewish Voice for Peace, Maxine Fuchsen, Jewish Voice for Peace, Jonathan Moss of the Israeli Military Refusnik and Peace Activist Movement. And that's all happening on Wednesday, May 13th at 7 p.m. at the Smith Building Room, 296 and 298 on the Portland State University campus. And we'll have these events at the reception desk here at KBOO if you have any questions about those events coming up. We're talking this morning about Zionism, and we welcome your calls. We're speaking with Professor Zachary Lockman, who is at New York University. He teaches socioeconomic, cultural, and political history of the modern Middle East.
Before we take our next caller, one of our previous callers had mentioned Zionism as a racist ideology or as racism. Professor, can you tell us whether, in your view, Zionism is a racist ideology? And if so, why? And if not, why not?
Sure. We'd like to listen to that clip from Noam Chomsky, maybe to set up this next part of the discussion.
Sure.
Do we have that clip ready? We're going to find out. This was a comment from Noam Chomsky, who was asked about, in this case, I hope folks remember, 1971, the UN passed a resolution equating Zionism with racism.
First, the UN resolution on racism. First of all, it was a totally cynical and hypocritical resolution. Whatever you think about the accuracy of it, the states that voted for it are, for the most part, much more racist than Israel is. So to begin with, the thing, whatever you think about the statement of fact, it's just pure hypocrisy, and on those grounds alone should be dismissed as contemptible. If you put that aside and look at the fact, it's also wrong, I think. Here we get into questions of fact, and on questions of fact people have disagreements. But in my view, at least, Zionism is not in itself racist. Now, if you look at the policies of the state of Israel, they are racist. But in fact, so are the policies of most states in the world. So there's a narrow point. Well, the policies of the state of Israel, like most states, are racist. And in fact, they should be concerned about that, and so should we, since we support them. I'll give you examples if you like. But most states in the world are more racist, including the ones that voted for the resolution. And the idea that that's somehow inherent in Zionism, I don't think that's correct. I mean, I could explain why if you like, but I don't think it's correct.
So there's a particular view, sadly not explored very deeply by Noam Chomsky, but Professor Lockman, can we infer from the basic elements of the Zionist movement, is there something that is inherently racist involved in that?
Well, again, if you go back to the thought experiment I suggested, if Zionism had found some completely empty island in the middle of the Pacific and set up a Jewish state there, there probably wouldn't have been much of an issue. But, of course, Zionism focused on Palestine, and a Jewish state was established in Palestine, accompanied by a lot of force. The distinction that Professor Chomsky makes between Zionism as an ideology and the practice of the State of Israel is maybe analytically relevant, but in practice, I have to wonder about it, because many of the policies of the State of Israel are, in fact, informed by its Zionist ideology. So let me give you a concrete example. The State of Israel does not define itself as a state of its citizens, right? The United States formally defines itself as a state of its citizens. Formally, legally, all of its citizens are equal in relation to the state. Now, of course, we know there's racism, discrimination, on and on. Many people were not considered citizens for long periods. But at least formally, the United States or France or many other countries, liberal democracies, are states of their citizens. Israel, in keeping with its commitment to Zionism, defines itself as a state of the Jewish people everywhere, which means that by its own self-definition, and this shows up in all sorts of policies and practices and institutions, it favors its Jewish citizens, and it discriminates against its non-Jewish citizens, its Palestinian citizens. And as I'm sure your listeners know, about one in every five citizens of the State of Israel within its 1967 borders, I'm not talking about the West Bank and Gaza, within the State of Israel proper, one-fifth of the population about are Palestinians who hold Israeli citizenship, but they are citizens of a state which says basically, well, you're citizens, you have certain rights, but we are here first and foremost to serve the interests and needs and aspirations of the Jewish people. So that is discriminatory, whether it's more or less discriminatory than many other states, you know, we can argue about. As Professor Chomsky said, the 1975 UN resolution was deeply hypocritical in that sense. That's certainly true. On the other hand, it's not surprising that the Palestinian minority in Israel thinks of Israel as a racist state in that sense, because it does not treat all its citizens equally, and it favors some and discriminates against others on the basis of their religion or ethnicity. The two are sort of very mixed in the Israeli context. So in that sense, there are some grounds certainly for arguing that Zionism, as it's actually manifested in the practices of the State of Israel, are racist, or certainly have racist and discriminatory effects.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Professor. I was born in Nazareth myself, so I was born with Israeli citizenship to Catholic Palestinian parents. When we talk about Israel being a Jewish state, even though I was born there, I am not, because I am not Jewish, really a full member of that state, even though I was born there. So Will Seaman, who was born in the U.S., could arrive in Tel Aviv and under the law of return would have more rights than I have as someone who was born in that state. Can you tell us about laws that are discriminatory to Israel's Palestinian citizens, such as the law of citizenship of 1948, the law of return of 1950, the status law of 1952, etc.?
Sure. Well, there are a whole host of laws and policies enforced by the state which serve to discriminate among its citizens on the basis of ethnicity, essentially, whether they're Jewish or not. You mentioned the law of return, by which any Jew from anywhere in the world can come to Israel and become a citizen automatically, whereas somebody who's the descendant of Palestinians who may have lived in the land for centuries is denied that automatic right, and in fact Israel makes it extremely difficult for Palestinians from elsewhere, or even now Palestinians from the West Bank who marry Palestinian citizens of Israel to even live within Israel, much less attain citizenship. Land gives us another example. Until a very recent Israeli Supreme Court ruling, it was the policy of the State of Israel, through complicated legal mechanisms, to essentially only allow Jews to lease state lands. The state owns a lot of land. It's leased out to people who farm it. And the state systematically discriminated in the sense that it would lease land to Jews, but not to its non-Jewish citizens. And this was an important way, and one can cite many other examples, in which resources were given on a privileged basis to Jewish citizens and denied or offered in a much more restricted way to Israel's non-Jewish citizens. And the state has also carried out a process since 1948 of transferring very large quantities of land from its Arab citizens, from its Palestinian citizens, to its Jewish citizens, confiscating land, and then on that land creating Jewish towns, cities, settlements, and so on. And all these things, which are well known in Israel, there have been government commissions year after year who've acknowledged this, said something must be done about this, there must be efforts to end this legal discrimination and equalize the kind of support that the government gives to Palestinian towns and villages as opposed to what it gives to equally sized Jewish towns and villages, but very little changes. Which is not surprising because, again, the whole rationale, the ethos of the State of Israel is very much that this is a state for the Jews to strengthen the Jewish presence in Palestine, and everything else comes after that. And you know, one can multiply the ways in which these kinds of things show up.
Now may be a good time to go ahead and take our next caller, who's been waiting for quite some time. Go ahead, caller.
Sure. Hi. I have a question, and then also before that, I'd like to make a suggestion of two pieces of reading that I think are really excellent. I think on this topic, and maybe the guest knows of these works. One of them is called The Lemon Tree. It's a book by Sandy Tolan, and as a Jew, I really got a lot out of that book. It's a story of, and it's a totally true story, all documented meticulously, of a Palestinian man and a Jewish woman who become friends because he searches out his old house that he actually was born in you know, he was born in Palestine, and he was born in this house that was then, after 1948 and the wars, part of Israel, and he goes back to his house and he meets the Jewish woman who lives in the house, and they actually explore history together. It's a pretty incredible book, and I think it's a very important book, The Lemon Tree by Sandy Tolan.
And what's the other book?
The other one is a play that has just come out recently, and people can get it online. It's called Seven Jewish Children, and it's a very powerful play, so people can just Google Seven Jewish Children, and it's it really shows how, in very human terms, how incredible tragedy of the Holocaust has actually been utilized and used to actually condone Israeli violence against Palestinians, and just to put all that together, and it's saying, okay, it's time to really face the facts and it's done in a very humane way. It's an excellent play. And then a question I have is, why doesn't the United States, even the current administration, push Israel to challenge Zionism and push Israel to negotiate according to the very reasonable Arab proposal of about five or six years ago that would have Israel be just within the green line and have a viable, vibrant Palestinian state? So why is even the current administration not challenging Israel on that?
Thank you, caller.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, and it's, of course, the really important question at this moment. Most of the world 20 years ago signed on to the two-state solution. Certainly all of Europe, all the Asian countries, eventually also most of the Arab countries, as you mentioned, the Arab peace proposal, and the Palestinian leadership embraced the idea of a two-state solution. Now, there are some Palestinians and many other people who think this is actually not very fair, that the Palestinians are settling for one quarter of what was once their country, which is the West Bank and Gaza, and giving up on the rest. But most Palestinians, I think, given the circumstances they have to deal with, have accepted this. Many Israelis do as well, but in fact, Israel has refused to go along this route, and as we know, have been settling the West Bank, settling Gaza until it withdrew for various other reasons, and has been pretty adamant about refusing to withdraw from these territories in a way that would allow for the creation of a viable Palestinian state. So the United States developed a very close relationship with Israel, partly or in large measure for Cold War reasons, going back to the 1960s, and that alliance, that special relationship, as it's often called, has only deepened over the decades since. Now, the Cold War has been over a long time, but in its place, other rationales for this very close relationship have developed, a common fight against the threat of Islam, right, which people use to sell that relationship. People talk about Israel being the only democracy in the region, cultural affinities, and so on, and a very effective domestic lobby, the Israel lobby, which is quite good at what it does in influencing American policy, especially with regard to Congress, and in selling a very positive image of Israel in the United States that's not very effective in most of the rest of the world. I think some American policymakers understand that if there's to be any solution of this, and it in many ways damages America's interests, because everybody in the world, and certainly everybody in the Arab Muslim and Muslim worlds, know that all those bombs dropped on Gaza were paid for by the United States, and that if the United States had not approved this assault on Gaza or the assault on Lebanon in 2006 or settlement activity over four decades, Israel would not have been able to pursue them. An earlier caller talked about enablers of Israel. The chief enabler of Israel, in ways that are ultimately disastrous for Israel itself, is the United States. And unfortunately, it's become rather a taboo in American politics to even discuss this. In both presidential candidates last fall insisted that they were Israel's strongest supporter. It remains to be seen what the new Obama administration will actually do, and there have been at least hints of some change of policy, and certainly they'll get much more involved in trying to get negotiations going than the Bush administration. But unless there's some clear American statement that the United States really believes in the two-state solution and will really try to implement it, which means laying down the law to Israel and saying basically Israel has to pull out of the West Bank and has to get those settlements out of there and agree to the establishment of a viable, authentic, independent Palestinian state, nothing's going to happen, because the only thing the Israelis really care about is American support. Which means that it's very much in our court, in a sense. It's very much up to us here in the United States to talk about this issue, to educate people, and to put it on the national agenda in a way that it hasn't been for probably forever.
And again, we're talking with Professor Zachary Lockman of New York University, and we're talking about the topic of Zionism this morning on One Land, Many Voices. Professor Lockman, I want to return to this question of the racism of Zionism, and I'd like to pose the question in a somewhat different way. I think a lot of people, a lot of Jews in particular in the United States, self-identify themselves as Zionists. And my own feeling, talking with a lot of these folks, is that they are not racists. And yet, I think within many communities and many people coming to this conflict, I think if you identify yourself as a Zionist today, it's as if you were saying, I'm a racist. I support discrimination. And yet I think that's quite an unfair characterization for a lot of people who self-identify as Zionists. I wonder how can we explain that, or how would you confront that question?
I think you've put your finger on something extremely important. People bandy Zionism about in lots of ways, whether positively or negatively, and it means a lot of different things to different people. So we've talked some about some of the ways in which Zionism can be seen as racist or an ideology which in the state of Israel fosters or rationalizes discrimination. But there are also in Israel and certainly in the United States a lot of very good, well-meaning people who support Israel, who identify with it, but don't for a second think of themselves as racists. And we know from public opinion surveys that a great number of American Jews, the great majority of American Jews even, not the leadership, but the rank and file, would support a two-state solution and are much less extreme than many of the voices that come out of certain circles in Israel, or the kind of people we tend to hear most about. So there are many people who feel that Israel is important to them, it's part of their Jewish identity. They could certainly live happily with an Israel within its 1967 borders. Although, again, that, as we've talked about, raises other kinds of questions about what kind of state that would be in relation to its non-Jewish minority and its non-Jewish citizens. So I think we don't want to engage in crude Zionist bashing because it doesn't get us very far in terms of understanding or politically. And I think we all need to find ways to talk to people to help them acquire a fuller understanding of the realities of what goes on the ground, and maybe not get so hung up on labels about Zionism as such, but instead focus on the actual, you know, day-to-day forms of violence with regard to the West Bank and Gaza under occupation, and the forms of institutionalized discrimination that take place within the State of Israel, and the struggle of Israel's Palestinian minority to redress that and achieve full equality in their own homeland.
But, Professor, how can one who supports Zionism also support Israel as a state of all of its citizens when the demographic trend shows that within a few decades, the non-Jewish population of the state of Israel within the Green Line will exceed its Jewish population?
Well, I don't think you mean within the Green Line. I think within a relatively small number of years, certainly within a decade, Palestine as a whole, including the State of Israel within the Green Line, the West Bank, and Gaza, the Palestinian population will equal or exceed the Jewish population. Within the State of Israel proper, within those 1967 boundaries, there's an 80% Jewish majority, and it may be diminishing slowly, but it's not going to change radically for the period ahead. So the larger question is, as many people have suggested, Israel is tending towards an apartheid situation in the sense that this Jewish population, which will soon be a minority, is ruling over a what will soon be a Palestinian Arab majority in all of Palestine, and that Jewish minority will have rights, it'll be part of a functioning democracy, but it'll rule over a largely disenfranchised or occupied Palestinian population. You point to a real contradiction. I don't mean for a minute to deny it. If one thinks it through, you know, one can certainly make the case that the existence of a Jewish state in a land which, again, before 1948 was majority Palestinian and which the indigenous population continues to be denied their rights and certainly their national aspirations is a problem. I was talking more on the day-to-day political level and ways of talking to people so they don't shut down immediately and are able to hear this and maybe begin to think about this in a different kind of way.
I understand that, Professor. So let me just push this a little bit further. We're coming toward the end of our program, but I think this is an important issue. My understanding is that 75% of the State of Israel is Jewish and 25% non-Jewish, several percent, 4 or 5% being Christians who came from Russia, who had one grandparent who is Jewish. So that said, we don't want to shut down discussion among those who are pro-Zionist and those who are either non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, but if you end up with a state that is majority non-Jewish, how can Zionism survive as an ideology and not be racist?
Well, again, I'm not sure. Let's imagine that the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza came to an end. There was a Palestinian state. So let's just talk about Israel proper, which I think is where your question mm-hmm. is going. So it has a large Jewish majority, 75-80%, however you want to count it. I certainly agree with you that questions remain, because, it remains a state that defines itself as not a state of its citizens, but a state of the Jewish people, and that is inherently discriminatory against its non-Jewish citizens. It's as if people said the United States is a state of white Protestants everywhere. And, of course, everybody who wasn't a white Protestant would find that deeply discriminatory and unacceptable and would fight against it. That's sort of a parallel with how Israel defines itself. So I certainly agree with you that and that's where I disagreed with Chomsky, that the Zionist ideology would still be an issue with regard to the State of Israel proper, even if there was no occupation. And so it's certainly reasonable that non-Jews who are citizens of Israel would continue to struggle for full equality, for making Israel a state of its citizens. And there are Palestinians and others who make that demand and are struggling for that within the state of Israel. So
we're going to have to leave it there because we're at the end of our hour. I want to thank our guest, Professor Zachary Lockman of New York University. Professor Lockman, thank you for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Thank you for tuning in to Community Radio KBOO. We're coming into our next pledge drive in the next couple weeks, and we hope, even though you won't hear us pledge wrapping during this program, that you will call up, renew your pledge, increase your pledge, join KBOO, the KBOO family. And thank you for tuning in this month to One Land, Many Voices. Thank you.